We're bloggingheads.tv. Once again, I'm back.
It is so nice to have you back. I can't see you, but are you tanned and rested and ready to go? Have you decompressed?
I'm afraid I'm still shiny and pale-faced as always.
Oh, as white as ever. Well, you were sorely missed here at Bloggins TV. I mean that most sincerely. The mail was at least 3-1 in your favor. I literally have not spoken to you since you left our bosom for the embrace of the Mike Huckabee. Is that his name?
Huckabee.
No,
yes.
How quickly we forget. The Mike Huckabee campaign. And I thought we'd just start by, you know, talking a little bit about your experiences there. This, of course, is not your first presidential campaign. You worked for George H.W. Bush, and you won his White House afterwards.
And Ronald Reagan, too, in 80 and 84 campaigns.
What did you do? You were pretty much a young buck back then.
I was very young. I'm very lucky to get plugged in right out of college, basically.
You were in charge of the hair coloring? And hey, kid, this is really important. Hold on to the bottle.
anyway, you asked about the Huckabee.
So tell me, first, how did it come about that you hooked up with Huckabee, and what made you want to leave punditry for actually the real world?
The real world of presidential campaigns. Well, I'd always, as you know, I'd been a fan of Huckabee's. I thought he had a good message. I thought he had the right mix of ideas, you know, for the Republican Party and for the country. And then when Ed Rollins got involved, my old boss from the Reagan White House and the Reagan 84 re-election campaign, I thought, well, this would be fun. It would be kind of an adventure. Do some good. Maybe win the nomination. Maybe not. But it would be just a good change of pace. So I did it. It was sort of a lark. And
we won't tell him that. But one thing that I wondered about, I didn't get a chance to talk to you at the time, was that, as our regular viewers know, if they haven't forgotten by now, you are opposed to the war, and you pretty much, I think, want to see it over with as soon as it can reasonably be done with. And that wasn't Mike Huckabee's position. So on this, having this fundamental disagreement, I realized, you didn't have much choice among the Republicans on the war issue except for Ron Paul. I mean, did that give you any pause?
Well, it did give me some concern, but not a lot, because frankly, we're in the war now. I mean, it's too late. I don't think that Mike Huckabee would have conducted himself the way George W. Bush did back in 2002 and 2003. I think that there's been a lot of learning since about what's possible and feasible in the Middle East and what isn't.
Like, know the difference between Shia and Sunni before you invade a country.
We've all learned the differences of these issues, and
John McCain still needs a tutorial now and then, it seems. Sorry, couldn't resist.
I think that the challenge the country faces now is to come up with some sort of reasonable, plausible exit from Iraq, and that's the difficulty of that has slowed down even such certified doves as Juan Cole, the well-known Michigan academic, who has said himself, we just can't withdraw immediately from Iraq. Right. We have to come up with some sort of negotiated, stage, timed withdrawal.
Well, there you go, dragging us into substance when we want the gossip. So what did you do for Governor
Huckabee? I was a senior advisor. I just helped on everything. I helped on the position papers and communications and so on, and the debates and so on. It was a good experience.
Give us a scene from inside the crucible. Was there like any moment of certain of particular intensity or any?
Well, we had
to Jim Pinkerton and they say, Jim, what do we do? Governor, you must tell the truth.
a highlight of the campaign certainly was going to a home school basketball tournament in St. John's, Michigan. Back in January, this is the homeschoolers are very well organized. There's a lot of them.
Are they tall? Do homeschoolers tend to be taller?
They are energetic, and Huckabee, there's an event that obviously he'd been planned to do, but he came and he said, "Listen, I'm interrupting your game because I want to give a little talk to your parents and so on. So you just have to bear with me here." And he gave a great speech about God, faith, and And then just said, you know, at the very end, as he wrapped up a brief speech, he said, listen, I want you to go out there and be good sports. I want you to play hard, but be good sports. And I just thought it was such a sweet moment of, you know, if nothing else comes of this campaign, that these kids are getting a little message about good sportsmanship. I thought was sort of a high, it was very American moment, if you will, of, you know, heartfelt conviction out there in the middle of the country, in a way that just the pundit class and the, you know, just wouldn't see otherwise. And
gosh, if only George Bush could pull off such moments, the world would be a lot better place. The homeschooling thing was rather interesting. I remember being in New Hampshire for the primary there, and went to one event, a Huckabee event, and met a lot of Huckabee supporters who had first heard of him through their homeschool association. I mean, was that sort of a main strategic part of the campaign?
It was a big part of the campaign, and it's an issue that still continues. And as you may know, there's been a court case in California recently where the state is trying to squash homeschooling, and it's going to be a big fight coming up in the next few years. I mean, and it never takes very long for the sort of the bureaucratic empire to strike back against homeschooling as one of those expressions of freedom and free choice that people make with their own lives and their own children. And it's going to be as you said, it was a major constituency for Mike Huckabee in his campaign. It will be again, because there's an estimated 1 to 2 million homeschoolers across the country, and they're remarkably organized.
Yeah, they do seem. I guess they're organized because they need that support network.
Well, they've created it, and they've created their own, as in Michigan, their own athletic leagues and so on, their own sort of parallel world, and they really want to be left alone to raise their children and educate them their way, and it's quite controversial, and there's a lot of hostility and a lot of litigation, and so it's a very intense political issue, and you'll see a lot more of them in the future, I think, just as the schools continue to deteriorate.
Now, why was it that Governor Huckabee stayed in the race as long as he did when it seemed there was not much of a chance? I mean, I have a theory. My theory is that he was just having too much fun, and, you know, he wanted to get on Letterman at least one more time, and he wanted to end up playing guitar with the Doobie Brothers. And until that happened, he just wasn't going anywhere.
He stayed in the race exactly as long until John McCain clinched the 1,191 delegates. That was the rule he set. And he said, listen, until somebody wins the nomination, I'm going to stay and fight. And that strikes me as a reasonable enough argument. It's the argument that Hillary Clinton is using in her campaign now. It's, you know, much to the consternation of a lot of Democrats, of course. But Mike Huckabee stayed in the race until March 4th for an election that isn't until November. That's actually kind of a fairly early withdrawal. I mean, George H.W. Bush was in the race against Ronald Reagan until mid-May of 1980. So to be out in early March, I think, is very reasonable. I think it was very graceful.
It just took him that long to get rid of his abortion position. Those things take time.
So I think that, you know, I mean, Huckabee left the race with his honor intact and no debt.
No debt. Those are very comforting words to a candidate, aren't they?
It is. I've been around a lot of candidates who ran up huge debts, and it was a struggle.
John Glenn, I remember, did a lot.
Jack Kemp had a huge debt after the 1988 campaign. So it happens. It's something that, again, a well-run campaign doesn't have. And I think Mike Huckabee has did himself a lot of good during the campaign, raised some important points, and I'm sure he'll be back in the future, one way or another.
Well, he did a lot for Chuck Norris, too. Let's not forget that. But talking about the future, I mean, do you think there is any chance that he could be on the ticket?
I think there's some chance. I mean, there's probably 25 names you hear here in Washington floating around for vice president, and I wouldn't.
What would be the argument for him?
The argument for him would be to focus on domestic issues, to focus on the Republican base, focus on social issues, and gubernatorial executive experience. Mike Huckabee was governor of Arkansas for 10.5 years. That's,
you know, what that's led to in the past.
Well, that's right. It's led to the governorship is a good training ground for the presidency. It is a microcosm of executive leadership. and to be governor and to get reelected twice as he was, I think is a sterling achievement that you know, nobody else in the race, if you think back to who was running in 2008, could even come close to that much executive experience at a high level. And that's what the president's in a extreme circumstance, that's what the presidency is. You want somebody who's been around and delegated authority and conducted cabinet meetings and dealt with the National Guard and emergency situations and so on. That actually is what presidents spend most of their time doing.
Do you think there's a political downside for McCain in terms of the general election in picking someone who will be who's that associated with the fundamentalist right when it comes to drawing in independents and maybe even some crossover Democrats?
Well, I mean, again, he was elected in a state that's more Democratic than Republican, four times total. He was rated by Time magazine, not exactly a right-wing publication, as one of the five best governors of the United States. If you're looking for somebody who has walked the walk of leadership in an executive situation and in the middle of the country, I think Mike Huckabee meets all those criteria.
Now, we should make clear, you're no longer on the payroll.
No, I'm not. Exactly. I'm under no illusions that there are a lot of other people who want to be vice president as well. Some of whom endorsed John McCain early on. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of names, and there'll be a lot of speculation. It's going to keep a lot of, pundits busy for a long time now, trying to scope out who the vice president's going to be, and I have no idea.
I assume his response, if he got off of the job, would be, heck yeah, but if that doesn't come to pass, what would Jim Pinkerton, career counselor, say about the future prospects of Mike Huckabee? I mean, he's not, I don't know, even know if he's working now, he's probably taking some time off. But what does a guy like this do next? Does he start his own organization?
He'll be a force in American politics. I think you'll see him creating some sort of political institution, entity, based in Arkansas.
With the decline of the religious right, Jerry Falwell's dead, Pat Robertson is loonier than ever, is there an opening for him to actually become a leader of that in the sort of the friendly manner that he is?
I'm not aware that religious right is declining as a force.
Well, I think infrastructurally, it certainly has.
Well, maybe. I mean, it seems to me there's as many churches as there ever were, probably more.
Well, I wouldn't confuse churches with the Christian Coalition, say.
I wouldn't confuse it with the Christian Coalition, but I would say that the number of conservative... the Baptists, Southern Baptists.
I'm not talking about grassroots. People.
No, I'm just saying. The point is the organizations emerge from the grassroots. Right. Some of these mega churches that there's one in Woodstock, Georgia. There's one in Memphis, Tennessee. These are enormous places. Right. These are 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 people. Two or three services a day on Sunday. I mean, these are big operations, and so I think that if we simply look at the demographics of the country in terms of who's having children and what states are growing and so on, and where the population bulges are. I mean, Florida, just to be traveling around Florida, mm-hmm. and to see what a state with, I think, 25 congressmen now. I mean, when I was born, when we were born in the 50s, I think Florida had 7. Now it's got 25.
There's no doubt to me that there are a lot of Americans who would fit that description. But what I look at is what's been happening in terms of Washington-based political advocacy organizations. And if you think of the old Christian Coalition when it was led by Ralph Fried, or the more majority when it was led by Jerry Falwell, not the grassroots, but the top levels in the suites. It seems that Concerned Women of America, that these groups just don't have the potency that they used to have, the political potency. Not to say that they can't, not to say that there isn't the potential mass support out there for their agenda, but it seems to, at the top is at least withered, and I wonder if that gives, for our two analyses are complementary here, not contradicting, and if that provides a pretty good opening for someone like Mike.
Well, I think by that reckoning, I think your answer is yes, it does. I agree. If the potential is there, if the constituencies are there, if the voters are there, The homeschoolers are there. Mm-hmm. Then eventually, most likely, they will find a leader. And I think Mike Huckabee would be an excellent leader. He is a good guy. He meets all the criteria. He's been married to the same woman for 35
That's
years.
That's really unusual for a Republican. I've had trouble thinking of a Republican leader who meets that criteria.
He's got three children he's very close to.
I would say the same thing right there.
Well, in any case, you might well be right. I'm aware that you're making little digs here and there,
but not at him.
No, but not at him. Exactly. And so if you're looking for somebody who epitomizes family values, who has no hypocrisy in him, then Mike Huckabee meets that test. So I think that he will be a factor. I think he'll be a force. I think you'll see a lot of him in the 2010 midterm elections. I think you'll see. I think he'll write. He's going to write a couple books. And I predict that one way or another, he'll be a factor in future presidential elections, whether it's 2012 or 2016 or whenever. He's a relatively young man. He's only 52. And
well,
so
by McCain standards, he has five more election cycles than him.
Well, if 70 is a new 50, then what's 52? What's 50? 50 is a new 35. He's healthy. He's vigorous. He's got a lot of energy, a lot of commitment.
One thing I really appreciate, Jim, is that you're a pundit, but you actually like to get out there and I guess even surprise yourself with empirical information, which puts you a step ahead of a lot of other people who just sit around and do commentary. But having been at this game a long time and having worked in these previous campaigns and worked at the White House, was there anything that you from your, I realize it was a short stint, anything that you really learned that caused you to, think anew about anything, whether it's about Huckabee, about Republican, about modern-day politics?
I think it's probably a cliche, but the rapidity of the process now, the fact that you could watch somebody, the reporters, like, including for the networks like CBS and ABC, they have their little cameras. Mm-hmm. They're basically one-person operations mm-hmm. now, and they film. They're working on their BlackBerrys, telling their editor that something's mm-hmm. coming, and then half an hour later, the story is up on the website, oftentimes with video, and you can then critique what they've done and comment and. In rare cases, ask for corrections or something. And the entire process can occur within a couple hours in time for the next stop somewhere. That was certainly an eye-opener for me in terms of just seeing how rapid the process is and how many times during the day that you could make news or not make news. Literally every stop you made, you make three or four a day, would be the occasion for a news story.
We here at MotherJones.com realize, that our deadline is always just 5 minutes from now. I mean,
right.
But one thing I wonder about, and to the extent I fear, is whether this quickened pace that campaigns live in and that journalists live through and that consumers of the news consume through, whether that ends up sort of things go by too fast. We churn through news, good news, bad news, important news, trivial news, at such a quick pace that nothing kind of registers.
You mean like Reverend Wright?
Well, some things do. Every once in a while something does, but there's just so much more. And but even now, the Reverend Wright thing seems like it was months ago.
Oh, I don't know.
It may come back.
I take your point. And look, that's a criticism of not only the politics now and the political coverage, but also just sort of life itself. Just the experience of sitting at home with a TV clicker,
mm-hmm.
And you can watch 100 channels go by. A minute, just click, click, click. It is changing probably the wiring of our brain in some way that social scientists of the future will you know, figure out and say, gee, that did shorten our attention spans or something.
How did your campaign react to this? In the, you know, in days past, campaigns try to have messages of the day, maybe a message of the week. Remember that? They used to have a message that they try to last for a couple of days. You know, this week we're doing the economy, next week we're doing foreign policy. Now it seems like, you know, it's the message of the minute, and at least when you get into these very fierce debates between, as in the one between Obama and Clinton, I get flooded with, you know, dozens of emails a day from each of them, trying to, you know, create, you know, brush fires here, there, wherever, while trying to, you know, advance their lofty policy prescriptions. It's a real swirl, and I just wonder, you know, what it looks like from the other side.
Well, you're exactly right. It is a real swirl, and things sometimes catch you by surprise. For example, in Michigan, Huckabee said something. I was there at the event. It was in Warren, Michigan, about changing the Constitution to conform to God's law.
Yes.
It kind of got some attention at the time, and so on. And now all he was really saying was that he there's two constitutional amendments he supports. He supports an amendment on human life and an amendment on marriage. And that's it. And he's never said anything different. He has specifically rejected other constitutional amendments on other topics. He is for two and only two amendments to the Constitution. And he said it, and all the reporters in the room just didn't think twice about it. But in the blogosphere, it took off, as Al Huckabee is some theocrat who wants to change the Constitution, you know, to rewrite it according to the Ten Commandments or something. And by the time that we figured out, in the bubble, as it were, of the bus, what was being said
about
it.
Did you have wireless connections on the bus?
We did.
Okay.
I had an air card.
There you go.
But, you know, it doesn't always work. And the point is that sometimes you don't really, you're following the news in Michigan and you're not really realizing that the New Yorker or something, or the Huffington Post is going off on some different direction. It just takes a while to kind of, you know, see all that there is to see out there in terms of what the media might be. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it just is, you know, I can see how campaigns much larger than the Huckabee campaign, I mean, the Obama or Clinton campaigns, for example, they must have a lot of people just doing nothing but being glued to the media all day because there's so much to keep track of.
It's amazing because I can't, you know, I could do one of two things. I could spend my days creating media or spend my days processing media. It's really hard to do both, although it's kind of necessary to do, if you're doing one, to do the other at the same time.
But I mean, I am kind of curious about the war rooms and so on that these campaigns are set up. And how large they are, and how, or maybe they don't have war rooms. Maybe they have sort of virtualized war rooms. They have people around the country just paying attention to the news. So I don't know.
And during the primary, I mean, there is a national office, but you know, things tend to be localized. At least your battlefront is localized. You're working in Michigan or Ohio and Texas, whatever. Come the general election, you know, when each campaign is going to be focusing on, I don't know, 20-odd states. You're going to have to, you know, I don't know if you need 20 separate war rooms, but you're going to have to be processing a lot more in and out than even during the primary.
Yeah, I read in this morning's Washington Post that the McCain campaign, I think, is setting up 20 regional campaigns.
It's very controversial to do it this way, too.
Yeah, it is.
They're going to set up 10 regional campaign headquarters in which the people in charge will tend to have more autonomy than in days past when you would have state and regional directors. So the idea is, you know, returning things back to the states, I suppose. This is federalism in politics, but you can see the how it could be fraught with danger if somebody makes a bad move somewhere.
Right, exactly. And you sort of wonder, you know, I mean, in a world of communication, you know, you don't really, it's not like you need to delegate these things, but they're going to try it. Maybe it'll be a huge success.
I know we had an anecdote in the book I wrote with Michael Isikoff, Hubris, about the Bush campaign in 2004. If you worked at a state level, if you were a state director, you were basically not allowed to talk to the press, and if you did, you could be fired. All, you know, communications had to come, you know, into the great big communications headquarters and had to go out that way. You know, if you start, you know, devolving, as they say, authority to, you know, these regional outfits, is it possible you get conflicting messages? You know, if there's a controversy and, you know, the Maine guy says this and the Texas guy says that, you know, I don't know.
I don't either. Right, that's one, that's, we will, it's an experiment. I'm sure that every campaign has a certain desire to do things differently. And I'm sure the McCain people are conscious. They just can't follow the Bush model in 08, so they're going to try new things. And so just the political scientist in me is curious to see how this experiment of theirs works
God,
out.
I didn't know there was a political scientist in you screaming to get out. But so let me address that political scientist in you. Was there anything that you learned about, say, McCain or the McCain campaign while serving in the opposition that would be of interest to our viewers and that might, you know, view how you see things as the campaign proceeds?
I would say that John McCain got the nomination for all the reasons that people are familiar with in terms of his own personal record and so on and so on. I guess I would just only add that, you know, when in a time of war, there's a seriousness and a solemnity to politics that McCain quite justifiably and quite effectively tapped into.
Yeah, exactly. Like when he sang Bomb, Bomb, Bomb Iran. I mean,
well, when he just said that, listen, our lives are about service and honor in the country. The people reacted, the Republicans at least, reacted very favorably to that. It was very hard for Mike Huckabee, who had his own message, to compete with somebody who, you know, could go, you know, and talk about honor and destiny and duty in ways that McCain could talk about it. It was just extremely difficult, and that's not at all meant as a criticism of John McCain. It's just sort of, it's just an observation that the sense of the direction of the country, the sense of the fate of the nation, is an incredibly powerful force in people's minds. And I think that will be a major, probably the major asset that John McCain has.
It strikes me as the only big asset, because as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, when it comes to the economy and these credit crises and housing crises that are ongoing, he really doesn't have anything to say. I mean, he's given a couple of speeches in which he's had not a single real proposal, good, bad, or the other. He's basically in favor of tough love, let the markets work it out, and here are my principles. If anybody else wants to suggest a proposal, these are the principles I'd apply to it. That's really not, I think, what rightly or wrongly, I think it's not what Americans are looking for when it comes to the economy. And as we've talked about many times before your jump into electoral politics, your recent one, you know, he's tied to the war, and if the war is going in October the way it's gone in the last week, things might be tough for him.
Well, you're right, they might be tough, but I just make one point, and that is I saw an interesting a poll said 91% of Americans are concerned about inflation. You know, very concerned. Mm-hmm. In other words, the sense that all this subprime mortgage meltdown, all the reforms we're talking about, all the new activism, the new programs and so on people are talking about, the sense that this will be inflationary, the sense that this will take us back to the 1970s, I think is extremely strong in people. And I think that everybody in Washington who's jumping all over themselves to dream up some new program to prop up the stock market and prop up real estate prices runs the risk of opening up the floodgates on inflation and higher interest rates, and that's something the American people don't want to go through again.
But certainly, if that were to come to pass, that inflationary impact would happen, you know, after these actions. I mean, that comes about later. So
the McCain argument, which I have some sympathy with, is that look, if you shield people from the consequences of foolish actions, you just simply preserve the bubble or inflate create another bubble for the future. And you just can't do that. The capitalist economy, for better or worse, does consist of booms and busts, and bubbles rising and popping and bursting, and it happens that way. The savings and loan crisis.
I understand that.
80s and 90s.
But when you have a situation in which, you know, Robert Rubin has explained what some of these derivatives are, and he doesn't understand it. It seems to me that things are pretty much out of whack in terms of the regulatory processes. And while Americans may be, you know, some may be sympathetic to the argument, hey, we're not going to bail out, you know, the bad players. And those people took mortgages they couldn't afford, you know, tough luck. You'll have to learn a lesson now and become an adult. You know, that's certainly different than saying we need some processes in place that keep better track of this, so that, you know, a few guys working at Bear Stearns can't sort of try to shoot the moon and create this these falling dominoes that even Robert Rubin can't understand.
Well, I can't imagine any government regulation that would eliminate derivatives, for example. They do it in Zurich or Tokyo or you know, London. Some of this toothpaste is just out of the tube in terms of what imaginative, you know, quantitative, computer-oriented financiers can do. I think there's a lot of discussion to be had, and I'm certainly...
But I don't think people on Main Street want to feel they're at the mercy of the guys coming up with these computer programs, and if they, you know, they always make out fine. They always end up keeping their houses in the Hamptons and the pools and the Jags and everything else. And whatever the right remedies may or may not be, I think just coming in and saying this is capitalism, you got to accept the good and the bad, is just not politically palatable.
Well, we might have an election on exactly that proposition,
right?
Where McCain says, look, we just got to sort of take our medicine, and Hillary or Obama say, no, we're gonna fix this, we're gonna solve this problem, we're gonna, you know. And then that there's this question of do you trust the federal government to make things better? It's one thing to say I don't like derivatives, or I don't like high finance, or I don't think that the stock market should, you know, go up and down so much. There's another question to figure out how to make it not do those things, how to stop that. And I think that as somebody who does have a Hamiltonian streak in him, who does see a certain value in the government organizing things in favor of energy independence, for example, mm-hmm. or building more infrastructure. I mean, I'm a big proponent of those things.
Highways, yes.
Well, exactly. Yeah. The challenge for people of that persuasion is to prove that it can actually get done, that you're not just spending money, but that you're actually going to get results. You're actually going to build, Hoover Dam or the Pentagon or the Interstate Highway System.
Or the Internet.
It's a little unclear to me that you can, in this day and age, with the way the federal government is constructed, that you can actually push a button and actually get the result you're looking for within some reasonable time frame down the road. It's not really clear to me that the government, as it's now constructed, knows how to run an adequate school, for example. And simply giving more money to the current system to make them and hoping the schools get better, that's been proven to be a hit or miss proposition. So the challenge is, before people say, listen, we're going to give you our money, you got to prove to us you can spend it well. And, you know, in some cases it has worked. I think the Department of Motor Vehicles, in certainly in Virginia, is infinitely better than it was 10 or 20 years ago. It's fast, it's efficient, it's been genuinely reinvented. I think there's room to show that in some cases things can be remarkably streamlined.
And didn't we,
and there's other places it hasn't been successful at all.
And didn't we manage to put a man on the moon with aluminum foil and cardboard before we had real laptops?
Right, that's an interesting question. This whole business of what happened to the political bureaucratic model as a tool for getting things done. What's happened to the Pentagon? The story of the Washington Post this morning about cost overruns.
$300 billion.
Exactly. Now, again, I'll sit still for any discussion of what went wrong here, and maybe it's not, I mean, including the argument, it's not so bad, it's just the way it works, it's just, you know, it's a messy process. I mean, but the question is, are we producing a efficacious military for all the money we're spending? And the answer, I'm not really so sure.
No. I mean, gosh.
Okay, fair enough. Then the question is, is the same bureaucratic procurement system and the operating system, is that then, if it can't run the military, can it then run the public schools? Can it then run a road building program?
Well, I'll tell you what. Right now, my third grader is taking the state test mandated by No Child Left Behind, and it's a complete nightmare. And not for her, but it wigs out everybody. Takes 2 years out of actual learning, and the kids, you know, are told, they all think they're being tested themselves, and they're all going through nightmares. I understand the logic behind it, but the practical application is such that it, you know, that I think it does more harm than good, and you just never know. You know, if 5% of the kids, you know, don't make it to school this week, you know, scores will skew one way or the other.
So, are you thinking about homeschooling?
You know, I have in the past. I'm nothing wrong with homeschooling. In fact, a couple of years ago, I almost did a story about they are progressive homeschoolers too, and all right wing fundamentalists out there. Just depending where you are, they are a minority.
No, actually, I've heard that too. Yeah. I mean, a friend of mine is a homeschooler here in Northern Virginia, and she says that you know, most of her classmates, as it were, or virtual classmates, are on the left.
Yeah.
I
have nothing against homeschooling whatsoever.
No, okay, and the question is, again, is can you make the government do the things you want it to do? And this goes back,
with a lot of yelling and screaming and realizing that it's not going to be perfect. You have a shot at it in some ways, but you know, okay, it's like everything else. Anytime you call a plumber into your house, you God knows what's going to happen.
Right. This is like, if you think, this is what in, you know, law they call the principal agent thing. Yeah. If I hire you to do something for me, or you hire me to do something for you, can we get it done? Right. And what are the hurdles and roadblocks that keep an effective job from happening?
You're great on those theories ever since you were the advocate of Thomas Kuhn and the paradigm shift back in the first...
Kuhn.
But let me just ask you a last question here, and we'll finish our debriefing, and on the next Corn Pinkerton we'll go back to what we usually do and try to find things to argue about. Having gone through the Huckabee experience, having seen the McCain camp up close, I assume you paid attention to what was going on, and you're now paying attention to the Obama-Clinton race. What are your big thoughts for the next 7 months ahead?
On the Republican
race? On the race in general.
On the race in general? Well, I think, certainly the objective circumstances are calling for a huge Democratic victory. The state of the economy, right track, wrong track, 8 years and out, time for a change, the 06 midterms. I wonder whether Barack Obama has been so badly hurt by all this back to Reverend Wright stuff, and the perception that he's not the sort of centrist, moderate, post-racial figure, but in fact a fairly conventional liberal Democrat with some decidedly fringe associations like Reverend Wright. Whether this has turned Obama into some sort of George McGovern figure with a similar electoral fate ahead of him, I think that's a distinct possibility.
Just Massachusetts?
Well, he'd probably do better than that. But
And the district.
Look, the polls now show McCain slightly ahead. Mm-hmm. And it's below 50, so there's plenty of flux in the race yet, and I'm certain. But I think the notion that Obama is going to be some kind of transformational figure, who's I find that to be kind of gone now. So I think we're going to have a much more conventional race than I would have thought, three months ago. And what about you? I mean, will you tell me?
I still don't know if it's going to be Obama. But as you do, I see all the all the objective trends being such that any Democrat, even Dennis Kucinich, should be able to win in November. But as you know, presidential races end up being between two people, and they end up being fought on the playing fields that the campaigns think are the most advantageous to their candidate. So that being the case, it seems to me that the Republican side, by keeping a narrow focus on those, on those 10 to 12 states, that may be in the mix, and by doing everything they can to portray Barack Obama in the terms you just describe, whether they're true or not, I'll put that aside, but just by using that political ammunition in that fashion, it seems to me that any Republican could have a shot. Now, if the economy is going further down the tank and John McCain can't address it, if the war is going poorly and he can't distance himself and has nothing to say about it, all the mud hurling or just negative campaigning or trying to frame Obama that they want may not be enough to save them. This may come down to a choice in which some voters are just not happy about their two choices. Maybe an old white guy who has nothing to say about the economy and wants to stick with the war I hate versus a young, black guy who has fringe relationships and who may be too liberal for me. What do I do in that circumstance?
Well, the answer would be, of course, you vote Republican for president and Democratic for Congress.
I don't know if people actually make that sort of calculation. I think, when it comes, I can see, after you make your first decision, which is president, then deciding what to do after that. But I wouldn't put the fact that they would look at look towards the Democratic Congress for savior.
Well, of course, that's actually been a pretty standard pattern since World War II. Republican president and a Democratic Congress. And in two elections that the Republicans won at the presidential level in landslides, both 1972 and 1984, in both cases the Republican president won 49 out of 50 states, and in both cases the net change in the Senate for the Republicans was -2. In other words, Nixon and Reagan were both reelected by enormous margins.
In both those cases, you had very strong Republican presidential candidates running against, Democratic candidates who were perceived as very weak.
The Democrats, that's right, against weak Democratic candidates, but then the Democratic Party at the congressional level did very well. They gained Senate seats. Senator Biden, for example, was elected in the middle of the 1972 landslide. He's been there ever since. Senator Harkin of Iowa, same thing in 84. So it is possible that the voters, and again, I admit it's a little bit hard to get inside the head of a voter who would say, I'm voting for Nixon or Reagan and then McCain, but then I'm going to vote for a Democrat to stop that president from doing anything, changing policy very much. But it does seem to be such a steady pattern across American political, post-war American political history, that one wonders whether it may well not happen again.
Well, we'll know in 7 months. I have plenty of time between now and then to change our views.
But tell me what you think about, you've been following Obama and Hillary and stuff. You tell me.
Well, right now I think that race is, 51-49, right now. And I'll change who's in 51 and who's at the 49 point week in, week out. I think we're just going to have to see where things stand after the end of the June, first week in June when the primaries are done.
And what about the argument in the Politico that Obama has it sewed up?
Well, I don't think that's the case. I think that if she has a, strong series of victories, and if she has some surprise victories, if she comes very close to North Carolina, doesn't win, but beats him in Indiana and Kentucky and West Virginia, Puerto Rico at the end, and she can come in and say, I've sort of cleaned his clock in most of the last 10-12 primaries, and with popular vote, if you throw in Florida, you know, we're very close, less than 1% or 0.5% difference. And then it kind of depends on what the difference is in pledge votes, in pledge delegates. I think if, you know, if he comes in with like over 100, we're still talking small percentages, but over 100, it's a hard argument for her to make. If he's, you know, if she closes it to 50 or below that, then she can say, hey, I've done strong, close and popular vote. Who knows what would have happened with Michigan. We have 3 months to sort this out. And it also depends if there are any other right-type controversies. If he you know, stumbles at all, if anything comes out, if he has an unimpressive debate performance, if he, you know, just says something, you know, gets caught on tape saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. So I think the political piece went too far. I mean, the numbers are against her, but I don't think the numbers are such that, you know, that even though I'm not a fan of hers, I can't say, logically speaking, from a political point of view, she has to withdraw now. And then, so if that's the case, do you see where they stand on June 6th, June 7th, whatever that final, whenever those primaries are done? And then we kind of recalibrate and say, okay, is it close enough to keep this fight going? And I think a lot of the superdelegates and all the top Democrats will be doing exactly the same thing. I think most Democrats want, you know, if they can make an argument to shut it down at that point, they will. But it has to be an argument that has some foundation to it.
Hmm. So okay, that's a little bit, you know, contrarian. I mean, most people in this town seem to be sort of, you know, trying to figure out some new reason why Hillary has to get out of the race today. And she doesn't seem to be cooperating with that.
Exactly right. And I mean, I think a lot of people would like to see her out and like to just see this wrapped up. And I think there's a lot of fear about what could happen, you know, if this gets even more bitter and ugly than it has. And they don't like the arguments that she's making about trying to sway over superdelegates, because it does sound like she wants to overturn the more popular pledge delegates.
Or that she and Bill want McCain to win in November, so that she can run again in 2012.
Yeah, I doubt they think that far ahead. But
you would agree there they spent an inordinate amount of time praising McCain, the two of them.
Oh yeah, but I think that was done in a way to make it look like McCain and Hillary are the adults in the room, and Barack is not.
Right. So, but whatever the reason they're doing it,
I think it's directed at Barack Obama.
But the point is, it is directed at Obama. But the point is, in doing it, they are hurting him and helping McCain.
Oh yes, yes, yeah. But without a doubt. And I think a lot of Democrats. I've spoken to a lot of Democrats, at least two. who've said, you know, that previously they either were neutral or leaning towards Hillary or leaning towards Obama, but not willing to come out and endorse him. Who've just been so put off by comments like that. By that sort of chicanery, that they are now, you know, not, won't support Hillary and will support Barack Obama. So there is a rising alienation factor. I don't think it plays with voters as much, but in terms of Democratic Party elites, the Clintons are not, you know, are beginning to burn some bridges. And so that will, you know, they're obviously doing what they think they need to do, but that will have some impact on where people's heads are at, and the superdelegates and the people to whom the superdelegates listen, come the first week in June. Hillary is not amassing goodwill here.
Right.
She's not banking it. So, she's going to have to do it by the numbers and come close enough to make a case that is very strong. I think the odds are not strong in her favor, but it's not. It's within the realm of possibility, at least within the realm of non-politico possibility. No digs at the political, but I see it differently.
Okay.
But anyway, Jim, it is so good to have you back.
It's nice to be back.
Thank you. Conversations, and I look forward to the next one.
We will do it, and it'll be sooner than the interval coming up will be less than the one previous.
Maybe before the next primary. We have loads of time.
3 more weeks to Pennsylvania. It's hard to believe.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye, David. Thanks.